Magnet Theater, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm Megan Gray, and joining me right now is Susan Messing and Christina Gaustis, everyone. Yes. My gosh. And we only have an hour, so I definitely want to just get in a few questions, and then we'll open it up to everyone at the end. But first of all, Susan Messing, if anyone doesn't know, one of the, considered one of the top teachers of improvisation in this country.
So sorry.
You teach at I.O., Annoyance, Second City, DePaul, Steppenwolf this summer, all of these things. Performer, instructor, and Christina Gaustis is also one of the top brass in terms of instructors, performer, actors, everything. So that is them. And but
rip you a grammatical whatever for that.
I know.
That is them.
It's them.
Put it on a bracelet.
Bless your heart. Great. So let's just start off. You've been improvising for you're veterans at it, and in a workshop, I remember you say this a lot, Susan, that if you're not having fun, then you're the asshole.
Yeah, it's rough, isn't it?
Yeah.
It kind of puts the onus on you to get off. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, how do you guys still keep it fun and interesting after all these years?
Because it's improv. You never know what you're going to get. Yeah. I mean, if you hate your scene, you'll never see it again. Yay. And if you love your scene, you'll never see it again. So it's the beauty and the horror of this art, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, I mean, it's always new, and I'm always playing with different people. That kind of feeling of, well, I won't trust you until, you know, 2 years after we've been playing together and going out bowling and fucking each other. That's I'm over it. But you know that feeling like you're in a relationship and about 6 months in, you're like, here's the creepy card. You know what I mean? Like, now I'm going to get fat for you. You know, that kind of thing. Like, that. I can't... Jesus, this is how gay I am. I had to put my mime cards on. Gay. But I don't know. For me, it's new every single time. It's got to be. You know, when you go back to that place that you're... that it's almost like a... it's almost like cheating. You know, my mom's in town. I'll do that wacky character this week, and next week I'll, you know, try something new. I'm always trying to stretch it, because the day I stop learning is the day I stop dying, and I'm too young to die.
I think it's the thing about improv, when you really love it, you can't give it up. So it's almost like that thing of like, I can't quit because it means too much to me. I need to find a way to keep doing it. And I think that's how it stays fresh and exciting, because sometimes, you know, you get used to improvising where, oh, it's your own words, it's your own scene, it's what you get to create. Sometimes it's hard to take a script written by someone else and find the freshness in it. That becomes the challenge. So just when you love it, you can't give it up. So see you when I'm 90, bitches. And you know what? If people still come and it still matters, you shouldn't give it up. Mm-hmm. Ever.
Yeah.
You know, you find a way to find the joy and that happiness in it. Yeah. And it means if it means something to people, it matters. And do it, because it's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Coming on to me right now?
My fiance would really be disturbed.
And I think also I remember in this workshop you said there's like some sort of like trajectory of like it's fun. Like,
oh, you mean my graph of improv?
Yeah, your graph of improv.
Oh God, you're not gonna like this one. Improv is fun. I fell down the rabbit hole of joy every day. It's magic. Yay. Oh shit, I'm getting I'm worse than when I started. I just paid $2,000 for that piece of. Oh, thank God, I'm getting better. 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 Why am I the same? 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 I'm great. I suck. Which is upsetting, because once you feel like you've mastered something, then your strengths become your weaknesses, and once again, then, you know, somebody's going to give you a note one day, and then your next teacher is going to give you an equal and opposite note the next day, and you're going to be so fucking pissed off because somebody told you to do something else. Like at I.O., for example, one of the teachers will say, only play yourselves, and then somebody else will say, play characters, and whatever the fuck it is. And I just said, relax your crack and stay as malleable as possible, and then something good will happen. Just, are you directable? You know what I mean? Can you relax it, make it work, and then get out of there? Yeah.
Is there a piece of advice that you, like, that you could, like, hindsight, like, looking back to yourself, like, when you were first starting, like, something that you wish you would have known, like, when you were starting?
Oh, God, that's a good question.
Don't fuck your teammates. years of shitting where I sleep.
I take an acting class outside of your improv classes.
Oh. Don't you? People say that all the time anyway, don't
they? Nobody said that to me ever.
Really?
Yeah.
You were a really good actress, though.
Thank you. But but I think that was the biggest, thing because we, I would get to, I remember the first time I saw you, Susan. I walked by you during a Saturday daytime in the hallway, that down going ramp at I.O., and you were coming in to teach a class, and I was leaving from a rehearsal, and I was like, oh my God, Susan Messing, I just walked by Susan Messing. Like, it meant so much to me, so I really respected my teachers. But there's a familiarity inside each theater, I think, and you know the teachers and you see them perform. And I remember going to my first on-camera audition and really being very stressed out, having to take written material sides and do them on camera and work on camera, play smaller than I normally would have played, just analyze a script, understand any of that. And I really felt at sea. And this was after, you know, a solid year, year and a half, 2 years maybe of improv classes before this happened. So I wish maybe simultaneously I would have been taking an acting class at a place that was completely unfamiliar to me, that a studio that I didn't know the people, where maybe they scared me a little bit more, locked the door at the time class was supposed to begin, even though that happened in my improv rehearsals later, but maybe where it would be more of a, I don't know how to say it, conservatory, foreign mm-hmm. feeling for me, where but that would be a really an acting class outside of my improv classes.
Mm. Well, mine sounds plebeian next to yours. Oh,
can I say, though, people fall in love in improv. Case in point, your fiancé, you know, met through
it. Yeah, but I've known him 25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People find love everywhere.
That's true.
under a rock. Yeah.
Yeah, there it is. Uh-huh. So you've seen a lot of improv. Have you seen it changing, or is there trends that maybe you think are not good?
That's a leading question, isn't it, Meg? Yes. But that's just my opinion. I don't care how you get off as long as you do. And some people might stand around vomiting their idea for a scene and other people fill it in like a Mad Lib, and that's cool. And I'm serious. I don't care how you get off as long as you do. It doesn't get me off, but then again, I can always stick a person in your tiresome left brain invented plot, so I'll still get off. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the point. I feel like I can... I don't know who I'm talking about. I'm just saying that some of the trends are stand around and announce and not feel it. And the stupidity that they don't understand is the audience is always on our side. So if I smell it, touch it, taste it, feel it, and fuck it, which means be in the moment, I try to make everything as day now as possible. If I do it, my audience does it. So it gets me sad when somebody announces clever and here's my funny joke and the only way to heighten funny is to be funnier and good fucking luck with that shit. So it's like eating a meal of Ritz crackers. You'll get full, but you'll be like, holy shit, did I just fucking eat a meal of Ritz crackers? Like, seriously? Like a sleeve of cookies you hate. Like, really? Really? So that, to me, that's a trend that's sad for me. And here's the other thing, too. If you're having fun doing it, joy is contagious. So all the people who are kind of now looking at improv, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. Please know this. Everybody now has this agenda. This will get my Conan shit together. Or this person will notice me and put me on X, Y, and Z. And when I started, I just wanted to get good at this shit. So everything that's happened to me has been a ramification of having more fun than anybody else. Do you know what I'm saying? So sometimes it's very difficult not to put your blinders on and say, my path is my path, because you're right for doing this, and everything you get out of it, if you recommit to joy, you will get the most amazing shit out of this shit. So it's just almost, doing this is very difficult sometimes. You kind of go, should I have been doing that, or what are you doing, or you're not doing it, or shut the fuck up.
I think my trend that I don't like, I think would be the same thing that you're talking about, which is commenting.
Inventing instead of discovering. Because that's the fun for us.
Yeah, instead of just creating two characters that get to live in the same space and we drop in on them for 4 minutes, the idea of commenting on one scene partner, you always talk like that? Oh, that's how you stand? Oh, really? Or, you know, where it's rather than creating a character and then you speak from the character's voice, their reference level, their knowledge base, their mind, you know, it's your good improv skills inside that character's brain. So I always say, you know, let it be. Just let these two people, don't talk your scene partner out of the thing that they're doing that's making them great. Just react from your character's core. And the commenting, I think, is a trend that I don't like, because it's not really improvising. It's not creating a character and letting that character live on stage with another person.
Well, everybody's funny. That's the problem. Everybody I know is fucking funny, so who gives a shit about your funny?
Yeah.
Especially
also,
when the laugh you can get sometimes is a, which is like the richest fucking laugh you can get. Like just that kind of pathetic.
So
like,
listen for Susan messing in your audience.
Like, that's the best fucking laugh
it
you
is.
Can get.
Oh, yeah. I also don't like, I don't know if it's a trend, but I see people doing it frequently. When one person misspeaks, they say they just misspeak, and then the other person calls out their misspeaking and the misspoken word. You know, they meant to say graduate school, and they said graduate school. And oh, graduate school? What's graduate school? Well, I guess you come from a place where they have graduate school.
I
be in the scene. So what? They misspoke.
No.
Misspoke. People
but what
misspoke.
If you turn that into a fucking gift, though? And a mistake twice is a gift. For example, one time in a scene, I said Starbucks. Believe me, I meant to say Starbucks. But I said Starbucks.
And then Starbucks became a thing.
Oh my God, Starbucks became the bastard cousin coffee shop of Starbucks. It was like the Avis of coffee shops. They just tried her.
Sure.
It was awesome.
Okay, yeah, I give you that.
But
it
was. He wasn't doing it to be an asshole.
If there's something that can happen where it's supported,
yes.
But if it's just something because in that moment you're just making a, you know, you're just like calling out your scene partner and it really doesn't make sense for the scene, I don't like that.
Well, the only reason for me that I say that it works is because I am the Yogi Bear of improv. Shit just flies out of my mouth and then I gotta own it. You know what I mean? So if somebody says... So.
Right, but I think we're kind of talking about two different things. Because
I know that calling out as smart, snarky improviser
is
different than character reabsorbing
it. I don't like the snarky... What I'm talking about is like the snarky, you're gonna call something out on your scene partner instead of just doing your job and playing with your scene partner.
But that's about dropping your shit, too. Sometimes you start a scene and then all of a sudden you get frustrated as an improviser, so you think, well, it's truthful, I'm frustrated, so what you do is you reabsorb that into your character, and I'm like, well, good for you, but your character didn't start out as an asshole.
Exactly.
So hold on
you have to
a
be,
template
the, yeah, the thing is, you have to be truthful for your character, not truthful for you.
For
it's your
plot,
improv
right.
skills and the character's brain, so be truthful for the person, be truthful for your character.
And yeah, follow the template of character.
Yeah.
That's the thing, that's why I don't like to lead with rational plot, because then everybody's retarded or crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least
and
in my
And the thing, this is what I always like to think about in terms of like the commenting. Think of like a football field and then where the commentators sit. The commentators are out off on the side commenting. That's what, they're not playing exactly. And that's what happens when people comment too much in their scenes. You're actually outside of the game, you're not playing. And the fun is on the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
In.
Yeah. I have a question actually about Del Close and sort of, there are a lot of things said about him,
yes,
and a lot of female improvisers have negative things to say about him, but I haven't heard that from you guys.
No.
I haven't heard that. So what are your experiences in that class and of that man?
The way that IO was set up was you had Sharna, then you had John Harrisall, and then you had Del. And you had Del for perpetuity, and you couldn't be on a team unless you're still studying with Del.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Del wasn't as much of my teacher as he was someone who affirmed me. Like, he liked my... I can't believe I'm going to tell this. Okay. One day I was doing a scene, and Sharna at the time was very hard on me. And I was in Del's class, and after the class I was dating some guy who was standing by the bar with Del and Sharna. So he overheard this whole conversation, and Del went, Sharna, you know that girl you hate? And Sharna sees Louie there, and she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. She goes, yeah, you do, the Jewish one, the one you hate. He said, she did a great scene today. And when I heard that from the person who was standing right next to that, Sharna will disagree now, but and she's one of my best friends. I love
her. I'll do Sharna.
But,
Sharna, say that? I never said that.
I didn't say that. But anyway, once that happened, from the... Look, Del was smarter than anybody. Like, the kind of smart that you could say something bright, and then he has the first edition of the book fuck the author and did speed with him in San Francisco. So you don't dick around with Del. Like, Del knew everything. So I looked at him and I thought, well, I'm going to approach him in a different way, in a way that nobody approaches him. Del was, like, cut off physically from everybody. By then, people were scared of him and the whole nine yards, and he was, like, kind of semi-old and cantankerous. And I'm, like, the golden retriever of people. So here, get your arm. Yeah. I was like this with people. I'm like that. So I would do that with Del, and Del would kind of be like,
uncomfortable.
What is it? But Del was kind of like, oh, well, burr. So that's how he was with me, and I just loved him. I just loved him as a person. So that kind of hero worship, I think now it's kind of insane. I think he'd be amused by it. He really is a lot more popular in death than he was in life. But I just miss him as a person. I just liked him as a person. I heard somewhere that he hated women. And I kept thinking, well, that's just not in my personal experience. He hated foolish people, and maybe and at the time when I started, I have to say, there were very few women doing it.
Yeah.
That's all. Yeah. Maybe that was it.
And then I came a few years later, and the training center had 5 levels then. Sharna taught level 1, which was amazing because Sharna taught every level 1, and she always said level 1 is the most difficult and most important level to teach, because that's where you get your whole foundation. So it was interesting. It was good that we always had Sharna at level 1. That changed too. Then we had like Peter Gwynn. Then we had you. Then we had Noah. Then we had Del. I had big time hero worship of Del. We were really nervous of moving into Del's class, and probably by then, the late 90s, he was softer.
Well, he didn't have enough oxygen to the brain by then.
He would come with an oxygen tank to class. He was very sharp, gave us amazing notes.
The kind of notes that would send you in the basement of your own soul. Well, if it was if he fucked with you, like, and said that was a bad note. And he was right. He was always right.
He was always right.
But it was the kind of thing that made you want it to, like, die. Like, it was so embarrassing.
Well, I don't know if I ever really felt that. I felt like, and at the time, my good friend Allison Silverman and I, we were in that class together. But what Del did was he made you learn on your feet. So he would side coach and be very precise with the note that he would give to you, and it would immediately make sense. Like, if you were open to it, he would be very precise with his words, and it would be so direct, it would just immediately make sense to you, and then you could make the adjustment and learn on your feet. And so for me, it was like that directness, like, really helped so much. I felt like there were things that I understood then in level, and I had amazing teachers all the way through that training, and but I learned things from Del on my feet that just made so much sense.
Did you have a class, though, where he would just talk about Iranian TV for, like,
no.
2 hours?
No, see, he didn't do that.
Some people
and so
did that.
I think that things really changed. Like, yeah, so I think that things really changed. And he was, and I remember coming, we had class on a Valentine's Day one time, and Allison and I came in, we gave him, like, heart-shaped Valentine's.
Oh, he loves that. He loved that.
And, like, he taped them on his shirt and was, like really sweet. Like, I have very, very fond, memories. And it was, but, I mean, believe me, like, we were afraid. I never felt any sexism in any way. Like, no, not at all. And he always gave us gender-neutral notes. They were just solid improv notes. Nobody got any varying notes in any way. They were just improv notes that really helped you a lot.
There was one girl in a class of mine at one point. We had so many Del classes, but one girl used to do cartwheels with no underpants or something like that. And Del had just no patience. I remember that. Yes, good times. But there was also, like, there were times where Del would have, he would come into class. I taught the class, actually, at one point there was only four classes, and mine was the new class. And so I taught right before Del, and people would get really frustrated because Del would just sit there for, and that's why I'm saying, did he sit around and talk about Iranian TV?
No, he
would
did.
Sit around and talk about just something he saw on television for, like, hours and hours, and then they'd get frustrated because they weren't on stage a lot. And so I said to them, I remember just trying to protect that, and I'd say, go to Del's class. You might not get on stage a lot. You might get on stage once the entire class, but he's a living legend. That's what I said. So, and once I started couching it, protecting it as that, nobody ever complained to me afterwards that they didn't get on stage enough.
Mm-hmm. I remember watching scenes or being in scenes in Del's class, and he would say, "That's a joke. That's not true." And he was always right. I was like, oh my God, the stuff that we were used to. But yeah, that was a joke. Yeah. Or that character didn't feel, that choice didn't feel like a truthful choice.
Oh, absolutely. I want to actually, because we don't have a lot of time, I want to get some questions from the audience.
We can go till noon.
What?
We can go. Her thing starts at 1:30.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the class is coming in.
Sorry, I forgot.
We've got, but I do want to make time for everybody. Does anyone have any questions that that they're curious about?
No question too.
Oh,
cray,
that's
cray.
Fine. Yes, Dragan.
Could you elaborate on that best laugh you were talking about?
Like I wasn't. The what?
You said earlier, you know, like the best laugh you can get is kind of like a.
Oh, okay.
What you mean by that?
Well, elaborating on the best laugh.
The one where people are sitting there, and okay, for example, 2 weeks ago I was playing with a guy, and I deal with a lot of physical intelligence. What the shit is right in front of you instead of inventing anything better. Sorry, and. My friend was sitting there like this, and he just looked like a coach to me, and I was sitting there like this, and I knew immediately that I was the profoundly retarded kid who would never get on the field in the game. I also knew that nobody would ever blow me like the rest of the football team and the whole nine yards, and I wasn't like, it'd be funny to be retarded. I just knew that I was retarded with my brain, and, God, that sounds so weird. But at one point, the audience just all went, and I was like, yeah, I feel that pathetic, and thank you for realizing it as well. And I just thought it was so rich, because truly, if I smell it, touch it, taste it, feel it, and fuck it, instead of, you know, standing around doing the yuck yuck factory, which I can if I really wanted to, which is, like I said, eating fast food, they will be right with me. A woman came up to me after a show and said, you know when you mentioned your junk drawer? I had just said to my husband, Ron, right, Ron?
Uh-huh.
I said, God damn it, Ron. You got to clean out that goddamn junk drawer. And then you mentioned your junk drawer. We went crazy, Ron. Right, Ron?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's like, so when I'm writing for funny, I know what's funny. If I have to write a sitcom, I know that they're going to hand me my sides back and say, fucking clean this shit up and add some more jokes. I know that if I'm writing an essay, I'm going to switch the K sound around because it ends prettier this way. Here's all about discovery for me. That's just what the form is about, as organic as possible for me. So when someone, if I smell it, touch it, taste it, feel it, and fuck it, so will they. And so that the comedy is like a result of commitment and recommitment to your choices, not that it's funny choices, because I could never in my life think that junk drawer was comedy. But specificity is what gets my audience off, not funny specificity. The difference between a funyun, you know those roundy ones, those horrible oniony things, versus bugles. You're even thinking about if you've ever eaten a bugle, unless you come from a family like mine. My mom was like, she had wheat germ at the bottom of our cereal bowls. So I was like, that ain't no bunny, bitch. Like, we started early and horrible on that shit. But even just eating a bugle, like, you know what I'm talking about? That's getting me off far times more than, like, I'm made of funny, you know? And it just doesn't work as well in this kind of comedy. And believe me, when I'm writing sketch, I'm going back there too. Even if you guys do sketch and you know that there's a moment that always used to be fucking funny and it's not funny anymore, and you're like, how the fuck did I lose it? So you pop it even harder and you play the joke even sharper, and it gets worse and worse and worse. That happened to me on main stage at Second City, and it's not a good feeling. And Mick, my director, finally came back and he said, Susan, your desire to pop that joke, you need to actually relax your crack and go back and play the moment, and the humor will rise instead of the waka waka ding dong funny joke, my perception of what's funny. Because at no time can I tell my audience what I think is funny, because if I go, this is funny, that's the only time this audience will go, no, it isn't. That's why even when you tell a truthful story in a monologue and you go, here's a funny story, the audience is like, you better prove it, bitch. Like, you know what I mean? There's that kind of, so just tell a story and then we'll decide. No matter what, that Armando character, oh, Armando, that the monologist, Armando, the monologist, because you have to understand, Armando, can I say that, how Armando started on that?
Yeah.
Armando was an awesome storyteller, the best storyteller on the planet, but he really didn't improvise a lot. So this is where we treat each other like artists and heroes. Keckner and a bunch of people said, aw, let's make Armando the star of the show. And they made the whole show around him, and now it's done all over the world. And apparently Armando was at I.O. like a year or two ago, stood online to buy his tickets, and somebody was like, what the fuck are you doing, man? You're fucking Armando! Like, roll out the carpet, you know. Does that sort of answer your question? It's like, it's so so fucking rich when you're just with them, you know what I mean? We keep waiting for the validation of the laugh to validate us, and it really is a consequence of this shit. Same with plot for me. If you build it, if I go eggs, bacon, toast, I get to discover breakfast instead of vomit it and go, what the fuck did you eat this morning? Do you know what I mean? So that to me is going to get me off more. And that doesn't mean I'm right. I'm just saying that's how I get off, and that's why after over 25 years of being an improviser, I can still be interested in what's going on if somebody's invested in it.
So now does that laugh make sense?
Something, Susan, you said this in the office before. You said you had enough time to judge in the scene.
Yeah.
And so you had to get back into the moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. So how do you stay in the moment? Like, if you realize that you're judging the scene while you're in it, how do you get back into it?
Well, even after 25 years, I can go to snotty cunty world. So this is what I do is, if I have a time in the middle of a scene to say, this ain't good, then I rub my fucking face back in it until I like it again. Mm-hmm. Because the audience saw it and liked it until you indicated one of three things. I suck, you suck, or this sucks, and then I hate your fucking guts because you told me to. You know what I mean? You told me to hate you. So I feel like if I reinvest in it, something that maybe would have ended up in the mediocre pile ends up in the classic pile just by recommitment to it. So I still go to a place of bad touch, so I go back and make bad touch good touch.
Yeah.
That's all.
How do you get back in the moment?
Yeah,
recommitment, like Susan just said, and I always say just make a new declaration, something that you see, hear, touch, taste, smell, feel in the scene. It'll land on, okay. It'll land on your scene partner in the moment. They'll be back in the moment.
Yeah.
Or go to your emotions. Your emotions will never let you down. So make an emotional choice that then connects you in the moment to your scene partner.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. If you get lost in a scene, if you revisit what you did at the top of the scene, you will remember yourself again.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing. I follow the template of the character instead of the rationale of rational plot. Rational plot is I look out there and smile, and then someone tells me it's a witch burning, and I go, holy fuck stick, what the fuck? Then I change my shit. That's rational plot. You know what? That ends up beautiful drama. But if I look out there and I'm smiling, I've discovered a witch burning is a good thing, and now I tell you why. Do you see what I'm saying? So I'm always holding on to that person, that perspective of that. So if I get lost or I have any time to go, shit, did I leave my stove on last night? I don't like me. I wish I were never born. That's when I go back and go, oh, back to that person. And then that person answers for me, as creepy as that sounds.
No, that doesn't sound creepy because that's your character that you've created. So they're going to answer for you.
Yeah.
It should feel right. Like, that should feel right.
I have a question about your graph.
My Shit-Storm graph?
how do you as a person, as an improviser, can work when you're in that stage where you're like, I'm the same, fuck, I'm going up, how do you work in that, I'm the same stage?
I love that.
Make yourself.
I'm just going to repeat.
As an improviser, get better.
Yeah. How do you get better when, just because we're taping it?
Rant.
So how do you work when you're on that plateau?
This is where I really change it up. I have warning bells going off in my head going, I've been here before. This is bullshit. Mm-hmm. And that's when I change it up. Sometimes, I don't know, in the winter, if you guys gain winter weight. But that's when I start improvising from here and the rest of me turns into an Eastern European Weeble. And I'm just like, not good. So that's when I recommit to that.
No offense to the Eastern European
Weeble. I am an Eastern European Weeble. You should have seen me when I was pregnant. It was disgusting. But what I do is I recommit to all of this. And that's when you take the stupidest fucking class on the planet, take the stupidest yoga class, the dumbest African dance class, whatever the hell you do. I mean, especially if you're not, like, you don't have that in your bones when you do it. At the very least, it's unintentional comedy. As a matter of fact, the tragedy in my life right now is all unintentional comedy, I call it. You might as well. So at least then, the more I'm busy accessing all this stuff, because this is the only thing I get to own in a scene. If I talk first, it's not my scene. It's an initiation, which is the beginning. And a lot of people will come out and run out and vomit their scene, and we all have to fill it in like a Mad Lib, and I don't work that way. So at least if I have more access to this kind of tells me everything else. Even if you've watched a little kid in middle school sit out in the dusk and he's got his knapsack there and his whole spine is like this. There's that horrifying, defeated look. So even this tells me something. But what happens is we cut off the access to our body and we start thinking that improv comes from here. So the more I access that, the more organic the choices are going to be. Or maybe it's time for me to slow down and take just lead with something little and seeing how it makes me feel. Even if I lead with my elbows, I might discover I'm a germ freak or a surgeon. And it was just this tiny thing instead of trying to worry about the product. Product in improv means the scene is over. That's it. So you might as well start enjoying the ride. So it's those tiny little elements to revisit that you wouldn't think would tickle you normally. But when you slow down and taste your food, you go, ah, yeah, cilantro. If I eat a pint of Haagen-Dazs high, I go, the next day I go, did I eat a pint of Haagen-Dazs high? Did I even eat that? Do I have, you know, whoa. Because I just tried to eat I ate the whole fucking thing high. And I don't remember it. Unless I say it in the garbage can, I still think the calories didn't count because I was high. But if I eat a pint of Haagen-Dazs not high and slow it down, I can only eat a quarter of a carton because it's too fucking rich. So when I slow down and taste my food and take it moment by moment, I discover things that I didn't even notice because I was too busy going from A to X. So now I need to just go from A to B to C and see what the fuck happens. Here's the other thing too. We take care of ourselves, we take care of our world, and we take care of our friend. So Christina and I, like, this is a third of the equation. If I get lost here, I still have here and here to rape the shit out of, and then I can go back to, sorry. I'm sorry, I'm in New York. Rape means exploit. Thank you. Everybody's gonna go on rape shit now. I'm like, no, don't. Nothing said so. But I'm saying that I've got so many things to exploit that when I shake up my world just a little bit, then all of a sudden I get delighted again. So if I'm feeling the same, it's because I'm doing the same thing. Isn't that the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing again and again, hoping for a different outcome. God, I feel so Dr. Phil. So yeah, I'm gonna shake it up just a little bit. If I'm always cerebrally driven, what happens when I just lead like this, see how it makes me feel, and see how it changes my voice, and whatever. Or if I just keep mirroring her, we might discover lice in the school, or whatever, just because.
Yeah.
So, I guess lice would be here, right?
You could have arm hair lice. don't worry about it too much. If you feel like you're in a plateau, don't worry about it too much. It's going to get better. You know, if you're committed and you're in love with what you're doing, they come and they go in all areas of life. And sometimes when people come up to me and they say, I feel like I'm not improving, I'll say, you go for a walk, go to Prospect Park and sit by the water. Or, you know, but there is something, because you're here for a reason and you love what you're doing. And if you start to worry too much that you're not doing it well, you won't, you know? And then you're just being unnecessarily hard on yourself. And the rest of the world is hard enough as it is. So if you feel like you're in a place where you're not growing, don't worry about it too much. Maybe that's just the way that it is for a month, and then one Saturday you go and do a show, and it's the best show that you've done to date, and you don't really know what happened other than that you sliced some vegetables and made some soup during the week. You spent time with a friend. You went for a walk. And then you just got better. And I do, I mean, you say get a life, and it sounds harsh, but it is, you know, have a hobby. A hobby kind of sounds corny to us now, I think, in this day and age, but the best improvisers that I know are these very varied people in life. They have things that they're doing that they bring to their work, and then their improvisation, or improvisation as we know it, is a reflection of life, right? As we know it. That's the mirror that we put up to our audience, and that's how we connect with our audiences. So don't worry about it too much. Just accept it as it comes and it goes. And you can apply it to anything else in life. Working out, learning how to play a musical instrument, getting better at romantic relationships, or your personal relationships. You reach those plateaus, and then artistically you can acknowledge it and accept it and just know that it's going to get better and feel safety in that. But, I always think of Nick Offerman, who is this amazing actor who he does all this woodworking, and he's this amazing actor. And when you talk to him, he's this fascinating guy with a lot of depth and kindness. And so is his wife Megan. And you know, that's, go and have a hobby. Something that I just made a window garden this week during my mom. This past week with my mom, and it gave me such happiness. You know, and just do that, and don't worry about it too much. Because the other thing that happens if you talk about it too much, you're not going to find the answers to why you're in a plateau. there is, you can't go to any outside source and ask them to tell you the answer as to why you're in a plateau. Nobody's going to give you that answer. They don't have it for you. It just is, and it's something that is there that's meant for you to figure it out. And you become the most boring, tedious person when you go to all of your teachers and all of your coaches and say, can I talk to you for a minute? I know you've got your coat on and you really look like you're in a hurry. But something about me is this thing about me. I've been thinking about me. And now I'd like you to engage in talking about me and what I'm feeling me-ing. And it's like, I don't have the answer. I like you so much, but I don't have the answers for you. The only thing that I can say is that you stick with what it is, listen, learn, move on, and don't dwell on it too much because it's going to get better.
Okay, this is so much nicer and profound than rape. So much better. You're a smart girl.
I have a two-part question. What do you find most challenging
I love that you said that. In 6 years, there have been two people, one guy and one girl, that was so maddening for me out of the whole time. I mean,
It was me before my sex change.
No.
You both times.
She couldn't be easier. That's why I started pushing the agenda, if I'm not having fun, I'm the asshole, because I guarantee, both shows, I came off the stage, I said, what the fuck is that smell? And I went, that's me. That's what flop sweat smells like twice in the last 2 years. But you know what? I still went home ripping out my hair in large tufts trying to figure it out. You know what I mean? Afterwards, what that thing was. I can't just chalk it up. And I just can't chalk it. There's a part of me that never gives up. Because here's the thing. I have at our bank on the corner of Irving, Damon, and Lincoln, which I'm sure you know, in Chicago, there's a teller named Linda. And Linda is the slowest fucking teller on the planet. She goes to the fucking, she goes to the hair salon once a week and gets her fucking silver helmet hair. She has that weird mole that you just want to, pick at, and even though you know nothing will come out of it. And she's the slowest teller on the planet. And I fucking hated Linda. And you'd stand on the line and you'd count, please, sweet Christ, do I not? Fuck, I have Linda. Every fucking time. So one day I get to Linda. I'm like, fuck, I just want to go fast. I want to get out of here. I can't stand Linda. I just realized she probably uses a satin pillowcase so that her hair doesn't move. Anyway, because my grandma Jean used to do that.
Your hair doesn't break.
Anyway, Belinda started going really, really slow. And then she said this one thing. She said, where's Sophia, my daughter? And all of a sudden, I fucking love Linda. Now every time I go there, I can't wait to get Linda. Take your time. Your hair looks great. Ask me about Sophia. I mean, I love her. So I'm always waiting for the epiphany that makes me change my mind. I will say this, though. Every year I lead with plot to see what will happen. I always do it every year because I'm like, there must be something wrong with me that I can't stand on and say, you are my brother and we're in Milwaukee and this is our treehouse and why do you keep doing that thing you do? Every year I try it. Just like I try herring. Every year I try herring.
Oh, I can't do that.
I try it. Every year I try herring. I like fish, I like cream of sauce, and I like onion. And I'm like, this is the year I'm going to like herring. And then I try and I'm like, fuck you, it's sweet. Yeah. So there might be something ultimately in me that just can't figure it out with that person, but I will die trying. I will die trying because if I can fuck you, Linda, I can like anybody. You know what I mean? I mean, she really was the slowest teller on the fucking planet.
She really was.
I won't die trying to play with someone that I can't play with.
I'm not,
I just let it go.
This is my joyride.
I think If it doesn't, there are people that I love off stage who for the life of me I can't connect with on stage. And I understand the differences and I can love their work in many ways. And I think you're this you're this master of improvisation. And it is important. It is important to be open to playing with all different types of people. But I think for a lot of the times, sometimes in my classes or workshops, people will ask me, well, what do you do if your scene partner doesn't listen to you? Now, that's a question that just breaks my heart. And I feel like it's coming from a place of, they must be working with people who really don't listen to them on stage. And that's, you know, just this basic everything. Listening is everything in improvisation. So how unfulfilling if you're in a place where in your practice groups or outside groups, you're really playing with people who don't listen to you and it isn't getting adjusted. Well, that really does break my heart because I think how unfulfilling. And then I think like, well, after a time then, since time is our, it's a non-renewable resource, we don't get it back. Your time is a non-renewable resource. You never, ever get it back again. So be careful with your time and find those people who, when you're coming through the ranks, right, when you're coming through your training and when you're finished with your training and you're in the sphere where you're performing with people, you can, you know, look for the people who are like-minded with you and play with them and practice with them so that you are constantly improving.
Because, I appreciate that, but
I'm getting on stage with someone who I know doesn't listen to me, I can't do that, and I don't think that anybody else really should either. But let's not get into it back because
everything you said totally
made sense.
I totally get where you're coming from too. Look, ultimately, you're going to play with who you want to be playing with, doing what you want to be doing. But there are a lot of times where I'll be dealing with a shit wipe director or like somebody who just chews their foot in the corner and thinks they're brilliant.
Yeah.
And you know what? I've got to find that connective tissue that makes me understand them as a human being. So even the person that I have so many defenses and escapes
Susan
to play with
right.
people
you
like
do
that.
Have to find a way to make
you
it work.
You can find a way, just because sometimes you don't have an option.
But don't let it be 5 nights of your week.
No. But I will say this, though. Sometimes I'll try on their spine to understand their shit. Like, I still feel like had I tried that guy's thing on...
Yeah.
If I tried that... Who knows who it is. Now, if I tried that person's thing on their spine, I would have looked like a like-minded, agreeable person. I'm saying I'll still have my own brain, but if he sits like this and I sit like this, we're in the same kind of world instead of, God, I hope my shit works with their shit.
Well, and I think we're getting at the same place because through your post-training, your training and your post-training years, the time that you spend in those rehearsals, you learn how to then, when you're at Susan's level, deal with the people who play so differently. But you not that you could ever rise. No, I'm kidding. do you understand what I'm saying? So you have to play with the people who make you better and then play with the people who you then have to figure out how to manage. And yeah, if you're cast in a show where you're getting paid and you have to make it work, yes, you need to make it work, but first you have to get the skill set on your feet to learn how to deal with those people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh.
I think like training with people who are your like-minded people who are equal to you or better than you then gives you the skill set that you need to then go face any scene partner.
I think the Red
Cross... Even if you're, night and day different in your approach to a scene.
Yeah, the Red Cross...
And respect each other. The most important thing...
She's right.
No, but I think... I only cut Susan off 3 times because I think it's so important. But you have to come from a core of respect. Even if you know, if somebody approaches a scene completely different from me and I know it, I'm not going to go, this dimmer. I'm never going to do that. I'm going to be like, oh my God, I respect you. So thankful to be on stage with you. Now we make it work.
You always try to work with everybody. And I understand, though, time is short, life is short. I get it. In the Red Cross manual, it says, better one person drown than two. Isn't that mean? But that means reach. I will throw you my fishing pole or reach it out. Throw, are you serious? I've got to give you my cooler. Row, I got to get in the fucking water and then tow. And even then when you tow a panicky victim, they teach you more defenses and escapes so they don't kill you than they teach you saves. So yes, I have in the years learned arsenals and tried to absorb everything and make it work. Some people are like playing... I played with someone who was very difficult somewhere, and the next week I played, not you, and the next week played with someone else, and I was like, oh my God, this second week was like butter that you leave on the counter, and it's so fucking easy to spread. It's so awesome. Why don't we always leave butter on the, it was so much easier than that, but maybe I had a learning curve that day, and maybe my inner snotty and humility needed to be like shown to me, I think, for that day, because... If this is a sociological study of the human condition, it also deals with people's bullshit. And sometimes you just have to hold on and just like It's like anal sex. Oh. Relax! New York?
Play New with York. Good people and make each other look good.
Another question, yes. Oh, wait, Pupak, you already asked one. Jamie.
Just kind of touching on what you were just talking about a little bit, but what if you're the teacher or the instructor in that scenario where there's a student who's very difficult to deal with, and not just that they don't agree with your style, but they aggressively don't agree with your style and argue unnecessarily.
Isn't that beautiful? Those are the days that you're like, seriously? There have been times where a shit fire has gone on in my class. I'm like, man, this is fuck, I'm the teacher. Yeah, that's a tough day. I will say this. If someone is sucking out the lifeblood and the energy of other people, chances are they've got a lot of shit going on in their life that is preventing them from being a nice teammate. And sometimes it goes back, if you really want to waste your time, to thinking about who they are as a human being, and sometimes you have to, and you validate them as a human being. Sometimes that is the one bit of permission they have to be a fully functioning human being. But sometimes it is very difficult to take them aside or to push the agenda of having them be an integral part of a whole. Sometimes it's not the best place for them, and sometimes this just might be the day that you could either have the epiphany with them or you don't. I try not to dwell too much unless they are a way-ass distraction in class, and they can be, and sometimes they have to get the hard note. I usually kill with kindness on that because I'm so delighted that people are there, but sometimes I do have to rip new assholes and take prisoners. I'll always get somebody in the beginning of my session and be like, prove it, bitch, and then I'll rip them a new asshole in a few seconds. They'll be like, got it. You know, so, but at the same time, I'm not interested in being a toughie. You know what I mean? I'm interested in the joyride. So if they don't want to exhibit joy, I could take them aside so I don't waste my class time and say, what the fuck is going up with you, man? Are you okay? Even when I sometimes say, are you okay? I know she don't want to do it because she's going out the door in her coat, and I agree with you, time is precious. But sometimes when I give them a little extra unk, they might give me 150%. Sometimes they have the epiphany, and sometimes they come up to me 3 years afterwards and say, man, I was a cunt city population, me, I'm so sorry. Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. You can't reach everyone. My hope is that I reach almost everyone.
When I was coming up through my training, it was without question, we never talked back to our teachers or our coaches, and we never questioned a note. You listen to the note, and then you think about it later, and you process it as you need to. So it was just the standard that was not accepted.
It wasn't, but
so
now they
shouldn't be happening.
I know, but they do it. Isn't
but
it
then
amazing?
You have to say, just listen to the note, take the note, think about it on your own time. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can discuss it later. But you have several different teachers in your, several different improv teachers from different schools and different coaches in your improv careers. And you, if you are artistically mature, I like to think, and really thoughtful about your work, you cherry pick what you need. You take what resonates with you from different teachers. And then you embody it in your work. So really, Jamie, you shouldn't, you know. And there comes a place where if someone is really aggressive, you have to say, I'm sorry, this isn't working. You can have your money back.
It's really sad. I would hate to give up on a person. You're right. But I can say, you know what? I'm not going to be this. I'm going to be actually one of the nicest messengers you ever get.
But can I say something? You have to remember in this situation, we're very easy in improv theaters. And that's why I'm saying that I referenced earlier going to an acting studio where they would really throw some serious rules down on you for. You can't go, you know, if a person's behaving that way, they can't go work at a television show and act that way. They can't go work in a play and act that way. They'll lose their job. So it isn't acceptable anywhere else in life, and it shouldn't be acceptable.
I agree. And I, you know, sometimes I can tell somebody is doing it because they're supposed to. Like, actors kind of get bummed about it. I teach at DePaul, the MFA 3s, and they're really nice this year, but last year they were such little brats, and they knew they had to learn improv because we're no longer your bastard cousin of creation. We're, like, viable now. And so they were really pissed. I remember I gave them Jimmy Corain 1 week when I had to go home for Pesach. And gave him Jimmy Corain because he plays really nice and slow, which I thought would be great for actors. And the next week I came back and I sped it up again. And they were all like, oh, when you go so fast, it makes me shut down. And I don't know, something in me just like saw red, and I didn't say anything about it. But the next day, the next time we had class, I came back and I said, I don't know why that pissed me off so much until I thought about this. In the over 25 fucking years that I've had to go to auditions, I have never had the luxury of exploring my space for 45 minutes. Go fuck yourself. Make a choice, dick. You know what I mean? Like, there's something in me. I always want them to look like rock stars and superheroes until they went over my line. Yeah. They're like, nee, nee, nee. And I was like, no. You don't get to whine and babysit. I've gotten such tough notes. Frankly, I could have just run and just become a shitty actress. So, but you have to go home and sit with yourself and go, man, that tough note was not because my teacher's an asshole, although some teachers are, some, you know, like, not because they're an asshole, but because it's not about the messenger right now, it's about the message. And so for those people who are resistant to that, say, I understand, maybe it's a little difficult for you to process right now, maybe you're just being defensive about it, and that's okay. Go home and think about it and tell me what happens next week.
Or say you can have your money back. Seriously, that's how I feel about it, because it's like nobody's a teenager here. Like everybody that I've ever taught is over the age of 20. So that's an adult. And if you care about your work, you invest in your work, and it's not fair to waste everybody else's time. Beautiful. And I never could have imagined talking back to Sharna or talking back to Peter Gwynn or talking back to. Never in my wildest dreams.
You would never talk back to me.
I would never talk back. I would never had any reason to talk. Never. Why?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
When it was not like you would be,
yeah, we're there to make them look like rock stars. Yeah. Why would you fight me? I mean, you could say this really is a waste of your energy right now. Go get some, let off some steam and come back when you've gotten off or whatever the fuck it is, and then let's revisit this. You can say it's not a good time. That was weird for me. I used to always have to deal with it right away. And now I can say, you know what, maybe this isn't the best time for you. Let's deal with it later.
I think we can do one more question.
He's right there.
Bander.
You guys both seem to come from a play for the joy standpoint, like recommitting to joy, like you said, or get off.
I love ya.
Funny coming from Bandit.
But you know, we don't all start, or we do start playing that way maybe before we know any better, and then we get into this thing where
we turned it into rocket science.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So we all have been that the players. How come my partner won't do this, or how come you know, or like the person who vomits out the thing and does the math. So when was that switch for you guys? Were you sort of recommitted to almost that regression?
Oh, I love that, because I wasn't having fun anymore. And I thought, why am I not having fun? And I'm like, because it's not joyful anymore. I'm worried about doing it right instead of doing it. And as adults, we get panicky if we don't do shit right. There are classes in the city that you don't pass because you didn't do it right. And I keep thinking, well, that either means it's a shitty curriculum or a shitty teacher. Something's off. So my joy is going back and, look, we don't improvise for the money, that's for fucking sure. I'm not saying it doesn't support everything else we do in life, including our work, but yeah the money.
That's right. I'm in for the money.
But I will say this, if it's not joyful, something, if I stop taking the onus off of her, anybody else on the planet for making me happy, then I can go back and figure out why it's not working and then recommit to it. Sometimes it's as simple as Christina said of taking a break and getting a life. There was a point where I went, God, I'm miming a fucking cup of coffee. I just want to make a fucking cup of coffee. You know what I mean? And I did that. So when I came back, I was like, everything was new and pretty again. Because I can't always see everything through the pretty eyes. Sometimes it's like, I will drive to a show and go, fuck, I have to do a goddamn show. Which is so obnoxious and arrogant since the show has my name on it. And then I get there and I rub my face into it until I have fun again. You know what I mean? It's so sometimes it is just taking a deep sigh and going, okay, why did I choose to do this? And then boom, and then make yourself do it. And then you realize just for this moment, I will have a good time. And that will lead to the rest of that night. And you're like, okay, through the day.
I think I lost joy when it was like introduced, it was like level 4, where we learned all these heavily structured forms. Like what is with that one? That's the deconstructor. Here's an adjunct scene and tangent scene.
If your form like, is too complicated, it's not a good form.
Documentary, like that was like really for me, it felt too scripted, too confined for me. And I felt like my ensemble was looking like I didn't want to make the wrong, what's it's not a Lego, it's a Lincoln Log. I didn't want to put the wrong block down. So those heavily structured forms were joyless for me. Yeah. But some people thrive.
Some people love it, and
I respect that because I can't do it.
Yeah, there was one There's one CIF show with Mick at the Annoyance, and the Annoyance was known as the Island of Misfit Toys and this crazy shit. So Mick wanted to make it look really nice for CIF and make us look very professional. So he came up with this form that if two chairs came out and then two people crossed, and if somebody said the word "the," you had to do X, Y, or Z. I mean, it was so fucking complicated. And Mick is also the kind of guy where any of his hobbies could become his vocation. He's so good at that. At the time, like when he was interested in electricity, he rewired the entire theater. So he was interested in math at the time. So I was on stage. I mean, I was in his office, and there was this huge page of this one math problem that took up the whole like page. And I held it up and I said, "Is this our show?" And he and I had a great laugh, and it was the only show I quit in
my
life.
And the laugh was like this.
I suck.
I suck.
But it's true. If the form is too complicated for you and you're not having fun, it's about people. So if your form, if there's too many bells and whistles, everybody thinks they've reinvented the wheel. You didn't. So you can have as many bells and whistles as you want, but if you can't manage them, then maybe you need to go back to something that gets you off.
It is true. There are no secrets in improv. Like, everything that you need to be good, you will get from your teachers. Like, they will tell you along the way, and it's as it resonates with you and you internalize it and gain confidence and awareness and knowledge, like, it's how people become great. Yeah.
I think we're too hard on ourselves and play. You watch a kid on the playground, he's like, "You're not playing right." I mean, you know what I mean? But we've just decided that there are right schools of thought. And I'm saying, why not absorb everything, absorb it joyfully, and then end up becoming the kind of improviser you want to be, doing the kind of work you want to do. I float through every theater on the planet, and I love everybody, and I wouldn't say that they're right, and I'm not right either, you know? It just works for me.
I love about 60%.
What?
No, I'm kidding. Susan said I love everybody, so I was like, I'm like 80. No, I love. The thing is, even if not love, respect. You know, because I know, like we were talking about with scene partners, there are people who come at improvisation a completely different way than I might, or the way that I was trained, but respect them. And, you know, in this crazy, like, short attention span world where people get so, like, I blame it on the internet. I blame a lot of things on the internet, but people get, like, so, like, if there's a disagreement, then the other person is the worst person ever, and they're this, and shun them, and don't talk to them, and, but let's have a debate, but the debate is, like, pure hatred. That should never happen, like, in our world. It's like, live and let live, respect each other. It's different. It can be different. And admire one another for being able to do things differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately. But thank you so much. Thank you for being here. And thank you so much for being here. Thank you everyone for having us. And Susan, you have a workshop.